welcome into the latest edition of ESPN FC. I'm Kay Murray, joined in the studio by Craig Burley and Cheka Hislop. In a little while, we'll be hearing from Flanker Buff and James Ollie as well. But let's start by taking a look at the Premier League table, with the Premier League returning at the weekend and coming back with a bang as well. Manchester City taking on Arsenal on Sunday. The two teams separated by a single point. Arsenal in first, level on points with Liverpool, but with a better goal difference. And City just a point behind them with 10 rounds left to play. Is this the decisive weekend in the Premier League title race? Let's welcome in our guests then. Frank and James, both with us. Great to have you with us, guys. Craig, let me start with you, though. It looks as though Pep Guardiola is going to have some shuffling to do at the back there. It doesn't look as though John Stones is going to make it. And as for Kyle Walker, he looks 50-50 right now.
Yeah, so they have the players, of course, to they've got a good squad to come in. If you've looked at the bench in recent games, Ake, Akanji, Guardiola. You know, Guardiola's been cut out in some games, particularly playing at left back, so we'll see what scenario happens there. Obviously, you know, Stones and Walker. Stones, when he's fit, has been huge for him stepping into the midfield. Akanji's tried to do that, hasn't worked as well as Stones. And of course, Kyle Walker, you know, is still one of the best defenders in European football, primarily because he's so quick. So it's a blow, but that's what international football can throw up. You know, these international friendlies, they come along. Manager sits at home watching and praying that the squad's going to come back fit, and inevitably, you know, there's always one or two knocks. So I don't think they'll use it as an excuse if those players are not fit. This is a big game, huge game. Arsenal beat them at the Emirates, and last time out and then against the other team in the title race, they were outplayed against Liverpool and were very lucky to come away with a point. Should have been beaten. So in some sense, City have to try and put a marker down here because, as I say, they've not played particularly well against these teams, against Arsenal, sorry, and against Liverpool. And this is an Arsenal side that, OK, we've had this international break, but this is an Arsenal side, Porto apart, have just been destroying teams in the Premier League. Now, City are a different kettle of fish, but unless something's triggered a downturn in this international period, Arsenal have been the informed team going into that international break.
So is this defensive issue at the back for Man City being something that's highlighted back home, James?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it does feel as though if there is a momentum that can be created off an international break when obviously the teams aren't playing, it does feel like it's been with Arsenal. Obviously, Bukayo Saka pulled out of the England friendlies quite early on. Ben White refused a call-up. And if you even look at the England-Belgium game at Wembley on Tuesday, Jeremy Doku played 90 minutes. Leandro Trossard came off after half an hour. Obviously, Phil Foden and Declan Rice played the 90 minutes, but you suspect that those two are in such good individual form, and Declan Rice in particular is so sort of naturally fit that I don't think that would affect his preparation for Sunday's game too much. It just feels as though, then you look at further afield, Saliba didn't play too much for France. It just feels as though Arsenal have had a better international break in terms of getting some rest into those players. And if you think about where Arsenal were a year ago when they played this fixture, they just started to wobble already going into the game at the Etihad. They were missing William Saliba. There was a massive, massive loss for them at centre-half. And you just sort of feel as though there's a lot more solidity and positivity around the team at the moment. They're in a much better place to go to the Etihad and try and produce their best performance this time around. But it's really the ultimate test of whether they can do it or not. And as Craig says, they've been beating teams left, right and centre at the moment. They've not been beating very much. This is arguably the biggest test in Europe to go away to City and try and win.
Obviously, James just brought up there what happened after the March international break last time around for Arsenal, when it all went to pot, really. Remember those three back-to-back draws against Liverpool, West Ham and Southampton?
Yeah, but you had the likes of, I think, if memory serves me right, you had the likes of Rob Holding in that coming in.
So is it different this time around, like James is saying?
Well, it certainly feels different. And you know, you look at the approach that Arsenal may take, right? If you take Liverpool's performance, albeit at home, as a blueprint of how to ruffle the feathers of this City side, it was to get in their face, it was to press high, it was to not give the Rodris and the Fodens and all these guys time on the ball. And you saw Guardiola got the bench for Kovacic because he needed an extra man in midfield. That's normally the opposition that are doing that. And Arsenal this season, for me, have been the best team pressing, particularly at home, but they've been the best team at pinning other opposition sides in their own half and not letting them out and squeezing them. Now, that's okay doing that to Wolves and Brentford and all these teams, but can they go to the Etihad, and is that the approach they're going to take? They're capable of doing it, and City have flaws. Liverpool showed that. But what's the mindset of Arsenal? Is it a little bit cautious, or do they go there, they press them, they go toe-to-toe, and they say, no, this is 12 months on, we're a better side, and we're not going to sit back? I certainly hope that is the approach, because I think they're good enough to do that.
I don't think Arsenal changed anything about who they are. Coming into this international break, I said I thought Arsenal were playing the best football in the league. And had things been different, had things been turned on its head in that City were the ones sitting top of the table, City were the ones that everybody was saying the best are playing the best football in the league, we'd be carving their name on the trophy right now. I think there's still that little bit of uncertainty around Arsenal, because how do you cope with the break of momentum? It's great playing wonderful football from January through March, and then all of a sudden you have this break. And to James's point, even though your players don't get that many minutes, you're in the international break, you don't have that many injuries to worry about, how do you cope with the break in momentum? And that remains the uncertainty around Arsenal. Can they cope with all the different quirks around the last 2 or 3 months of the season? Can they cope with the pressure that comes in the last 2 or 3 months of the season? We know City can, we know Liverpool can, and which is why we're kind of still feeling that they are our favourite here. But Arsenal, without question, this is their solution at this point.
How do you see Arsenal this time around, Frank?
Well, I see them better than last season. I see them more prepared than last season. And I see them, and Xhaka alluded a little bit that during his comment, they are psychologically more prepared. But now, are they going to engage psychologically the game the way they should? That I don't know. I don't have the answer. I mean, you play at the Etihad against Manchester City. You know that something special is going to happen, and the pressure is going to be huge. Everybody is waiting to see how improved the Gunners are. And I'm not sure in that game that I can say that for sure they're going to play that game and they're going to be prepared. I think the psychological aspect of the game is going to be crucial, and we're going to see how they feel fighting at the Etihad against the best team in Europe, which is the team we still consider the best team in Europe. That we'll have the answer. Don't forget that Arteta also comes back to Etihad. He was assistant coach of Guardiola. Some players like Gabriel Jesus, you know, come from Manchester City as well. And they have all question marks that Arsenal player and the coach can you know, wonder, and don't having answers. And when you wonder, you question yourself, and psychologically you're not 100% prepared.
I think he realised, Arteta, that, you know, Kai Havertz has been a big topic, right? Mm-hmm. He's not been the only one, but he's been a huge topic. You know, why? Where's he going to play? The price tag? His form at Chelsea? Blah, blah, blah. And this sort of plan of playing him in the midfield, let's be honest, it hasn't really worked. Now, you can play Havertz in the midfield as a three against, you know, the weaker teams. But I think Arteta has... And by the way, Havertz has done okay now that he's gone up front and played as a sort of number nine or false nine. And, you know, he's not a natural scorer, but he's got some physicality, and he can link up and he'll run the channel and creates a little bit of space. But I think Arteta realised against the bigger teams, he needs to get an extra midfielder in there, i.e. Jorginho. And that is a better balance for me in the midfield, because it allows Rice to do a little bit more going forward and not have to worry as much defensively, and I think it helps Martin Odegaard. That, in essence, helps Martin Odegaard as well. So I think the Arteta Havertz scenario, and where you play him in big games, Champions League, Liverpool, Man City, has well and truly been answered. And I think the fact that he's had a struggle in the front department with Jesus and Nketiah, and he's needed somebody to go up there, has helped that as well. But the fact that he gets somebody in there with just to give Declan Rice a little bit of help, I think his and these bigger games has made the world a difference.
Yeah, sticking on that Kai Havertz point then, James, do you think Arteta's taken this player to the next level?
Yeah, well, I think he's got more consistency out of him of late. I mean, you know, this is a player who scored the winner in the Champions League final for Chelsea. And, you know, he had his moments in a Chelsea shirt. But, you know, it's funny, actually, when you go to Stamford Bridge and you hear kind of people talking about Arsenal and you sort of say, oh, you know, the Arsenal fans like him this week, but they might not like him next week. Because that's what they were used to at Chelsea. You know, one week he could deliver, the next week he couldn't. He was always quite inconsistent in front of goal, but there would be times when he would link the play up very well. And I think he was someone who struggled in that ambiguity of his positioning and the lack of clear messaging that he got from Graham Potter and then from Frank Lampard at Chelsea. I think he's reveling in just how precise and meticulous Mikel Arteta is in the role that he wants him to play in that team. And you know, Craig's right. Him playing further forward gives Jorginho the chance to come in and then create that better balance with Rice. But also when you've got Havertz playing as a nine, you know, every manager I've ever talked to about Kai Havertz always talks about how good he is without the ball and his pressing and how intelligent he is in helping, you know, team shape and being able to close teams down and win the ball back high up the pitch. That will be quite important, I think, for Arsenal at the Etihad. And that is something that he really gives a team that you can't necessarily quantify and, you know, the stats you've just shown with obviously the goals and assists and kind of thing. But I think also, I think we need to reference that game last season in terms of it was men against boys. It was City asserting their dominance. They won that game really quite handsomely. They bullied Arsenal that day and it was De Bruyne going longer to Erling Haaland. It was really, you know, Arsenal centre-backs without Saliba not being able to cope with Haaland's physicality. And really, Arsenal wilted that day. And I think what Arteta wants to see from this team and believes he has in this team now is more resilience, more robustness, an ability to be able to stand up and show character in face of that pressure. Because we know that City come good at this part of the season. This is the time they turn it on. They've done it year after year under Guardiola, and we kind of expect them to do it again. What we don't know about Arsenal is whether they can do it in these final 10 games, because they didn't last season. They've bought players like Havertz, like Rice, who've got that big game experience, who should be able to deliver under the maximum pressure. And really, Sunday, we're going to find out whether Arteta's judgment is right and these players can make the difference between a team that could win the league and maybe will win the league.
All right, let's take a look then at the predictions. We're actually going to put Frank and Shaka's on ice right now. Okay, not your prediction, Frank. What do you want to say?
Oh, yeah. Well, the prediction, I still
no,
go
no
for
No, no prediction
for
from
CD.
You.
Just
no prediction from
that.
You.
not yet.
Oh, sorry.
You're back on
sorry.
Saturday. We're going to make the viewers wait.
Okay. I just want to say something about Kai Havertz. I'm very sorry, Kai. Kai Havertz, every year that he played for Chelsea, switched on at a certain point. You don't know why and how and what happened. Last year, for example, from December to February, he was simply outstanding, the best player of Chelsea. But the problem with him is you don't know when he's going to switch on and when he's going to switch off. That's the problem. But what he does right now with Arsenal and also with the Mannschaft, because I saw him playing against France, the guy is outstanding, but you don't know what's going to happen on Sunday. He can switch off and have a bad end of the season like he had for Chelsea. But that's him. Great player. It's only to be fair to say that he has at some point a good period. It's not really nice to say it, but it's what it is. And it's who he is. Right now, the inconsistency of Chelsea fans we're talking about, it happens every year. And we can see that with Arsenal, it still happens.
It's not easy because you're moving on slightly from Havertz in a bit, but it's not easy coming in with that price tag, not in the greatest form, knowing that you're going to a rival, huge rival, whether Chelsea are not rivals at the moment, but you're going to a London rival who are going for the title, going for all these major trophies, and you know the eyes are on you from the Arsenal fans. You know everyone's asking the same question, why? Why? And Players soak that in. And when you have a bad touch or make a bad pass or miss a so-called easy chance, it sort of weighs on players. So I think he's actually come through it thus far pretty well. I think Arteta's doing him a big favour by putting him in the front three. If he can operate in the front three, he's done it for Germany, he did it for Chelsea. And when he was a young kid superstar, as he was in Germany, he was doing it regular for Leverkusen. But getting shuffled from pillar to post hasn't helped him. So I think he's more natural in that position. And I actually think he's handled the pressure, albeit sometimes when he's having an average game, you kind of see the shoulders go down. But that's normal. But I think, bearing in mind all the eyes have been on him, for all those reasons I've mentioned, I think he's actually done pretty well.
OK, what's your prediction for the weekend then?
Oh, why me?
Because I'm just asking you and James, because Xhaka and Frank are both back on Saturday, wow. But Frank gave us a little preview.
All right. I am going to go, because I've said all along, I think Arsenal are the strongest team to challenge City, although Liverpool have been great. I'm going to go for Arsenal to put a marker down, a huge one, away from home, and get a 1-0 victory.
James.
I mean, Arsenal's record is so bad at the Etihad. that is what worries me. I mean, I can see them getting a point, but I think I'm going to go with the form horse, really, and I'm going to think that, you know, when you think about Haaland and De Bruyne coming out from international duty, resting up, City click into gear at this time. I think it's going to be very tight, but I'm going to just go City win, I think.
All right. Well, there'll be a lot more talk about that game, more previews for it on the upcoming ESPN FC shows as well. I'm sure it'll be touched on tomorrow's show. Be sure to join us for that.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't a search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/FC. Just go to Indeed.com/FC right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on the podcast. Indeed.com/FC, terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac, weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good! The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Taking a look at England's most two recent results against Brazil and Belgium. Two friendlies, one defeat and one draw. So it wasn't the best international breaks for them. James Ollie was there for all of it. We've got Frank Leboeuf still with us as well. Where does this latest round leave them, James?
Yeah, it was a bit of a chaotic camp, really. I mean, if you go right back to the start with, you know, the raft of withdrawals and injuries, Harry Kane obviously very rarely misses his internationals, even the friendly games. And obviously as captain, he's a key part of what Gareth Southgate's doing. He wasn't available. There are a number of other withdrawals. Ben White, of course, refused a call-up, which kind of dominated the headlines initially. Then there was the whole furore around the St. George's flag on the back of the new night kit. Then there were more withdrawals after the defeat of Brazil. And then Southgate sort of said himself, you know, he kind of had this plan on Saturday night for the game on Tuesday. They got ripped up within 12 hours and he was kind of almost throwing a team together by the end. But I guess nothing sort of sums up the chaos a little bit as much as you know, a teenager who wasn't even selected in the original squad making a near irrefutable case by the end to go to Euro 2024. And that was Kobbie Mainoo, who, you know, really impressed, I thought, against Belgium. And even in the little cameo he had against Brazil, looked bright, looked sharp. And I think there's a little bit of a desperation to sort of board the hype train with him because he fills a problem position that England have had for a long time, predating Southgate, a long way, that they don't have somebody who can kind of dictate games in midfield. You think about the games that got away from them, even under Southgate, the Euro 2020 final in the second half, and Verratti and Jorginho kind of took it over for Italy. Luka Modric 2 years earlier for Croatia in that 2018 semi-final. You know, and obviously France have those players who can really just take control of matches. I'm not suggesting that Maynard's there yet, but he's got the potential to be that kind of player who could really give England an authority, a composure, a maturity in the middle of the park. And he was a real bright spot. But I think coming out of it, Southgate's quite confused, really, about his final 23. From what I hear, I think he's one of the coaches that's lobbying UEFA to try and get that 23 pushed up to a 26-man squad. And I think that's a reflection, really, of the volume of injuries that England have got at the moment. Of course, they don't have another friendly now until he names his provisional squad on May the 16th. As I say, he had so many withdrawals here, and he had one or two players. Anthony Gordon looked bright. Kobbie Mainoo, as we've already talked about. He had Cole Palmer he brought in, who wasn't really able to use because of injuries. And then there's a sort of longer-running debates about Jordan Henderson and Calvin Phillips and whether those players are worthy of a place in the summer squad. And I think he probably wanted to come out of this with a lot more clarity than he ended up with.
It's interesting that what you mentioned there about Mainoo and the profile that he gives, because Gareth Southgate said that afterwards, didn't he? He said he gives them...
That begs a question.
Exactly. Why
was he not in the squad in the first place, even before the great performance?
He says it's a profile of a player that they don't have right now. Is it just that he's noticed this now, having played him in these games?
But hold on. It begs the question why he wasn't in the initial squad to have a look at him. And this was, we've said this, James, even before the Liverpool game. Why do you want to look at Jordan Henderson and other players in the squad when you can have a look at these youngsters?
I think there's two reasons. One is, if you look at, generally speaking, it's not easy to get into a Gareth Southgate squad, right? You think about players like Jack Grealish, James Maddison, they had to earn, Ivan Toney before the ban. They've had to sort of earn their way. Trent Alexander-Arnold's a really good example. You know, somebody who had to really, even though he was impressing, excelling, I mean, Alexander-Arnold had won, you know, Champions Leagues with Liverpool, and he couldn't get in the England team. He was 50-50 to get in the squad a lot of the time. Southgate's not someone to sort of accept those bolters, you know, we tend to call them, you know, someone who comes out of nowhere to suddenly excel into a tournament sort of 3, 4, 5 months out. He has his squad, and I think a lot of that is based on the culture. You know, he's worked so hard to get a culture there, a group of players who want to play for England, and I think that's led to a bit of excessive loyalty. You know, I think we've seen that with Calvin Phillips in particular, Harry Maguire when he was having his difficult time at Manchester United, Jordan Henderson to some extent when he went to Saudi Arabia. And that maybe is where it bleeds into the situation with Mainoo, where from what I was told, and we actually did a story on ESPN it was about 4 or 5 weeks ago, that I was told that there was a big debate internally about whether they were going to fast-track Mainoo into the under-21s or whether they were going to put him into the senior squad. And there was a lot of talk around St George's Park about the staff thinking he was ready to go straight in. And Southgate felt, well, actually, you know, he's only played, I think, 20-odd senior games for Manchester United. And they felt maybe this tournament's come a bit too soon and maybe we need to give, you know, Calvin Phillips, who was, remember, player of the year for England a couple of years ago, a bit more time. Jordan Henderson, who's a key part of the leadership group, feels he gives them a lot off the pitch, arguably more than he does on it. And he sort of thinks, well, do we have a place in that 23-man squad for someone like Mainoo, who's played so few games at a senior level? But it kind of makes a mockery of all of that when you see him go and play against Belgium like he did.
I mean, I suppose, you know, he was loyal to Phillips until recently, and rightly so. Phillips hasn't played well enough in Harry Maguire, but I suppose those were positions that maybe he didn't have an abundance of other players, and I think that position at centre-half on both games showed it's a problematic position. If something was to happen to John Stones and Kyle Walker, you know, where does he go? What does he do? You know, we saw Enzo Konsa play, he's a good player. We saw Dunk play, make a mistake. He's a good player, bit slow, and I think that could cause him some problems at international football. That's a big issue for Gareth Southgate. You know, we have two of the favourites for this tournament, France and England, who I think have got big worries at their back four. We saw France play and get beat handsomely by Germany, and deservedly so, with Benjamin Pavard and Upamecano, and they were a disaster. They had William Saliba. We talked about it. Why the hell's he not giving this guy a game? Best, you could argue, has been the best defender in England, if not in Europe, in the last 18 months. And I know he played in the friendly that's just gone. But even Didier Deschamps, I think he's got more to pick from, but he's juggling his back four. But I think that, again, is going to be England's Achilles heel when they get to this tournament, that if they get an injury or two to those players that I mentioned, who's he going to bring in? And how are they going to have a back four that's good enough to win this tournament?
Craig, well, I have no sympathy for Deschamps or Gary Southgate in that matter. In a way that they've been there for a while. They know all their players. They know how they play. It's their job to find the chemistry and to find the players and to have one player and the substitute and the substitute of the substitute. They've been there for a while. They have no excuse whatsoever to struggle to find somebody else. They have what we call a problem of rich people. You know, it's like, oh, well, I have to get the bread. You know, do I get the Maserati or the Porsche? You know, that's what it is with France and England. They have, okay, Harry Kane is a big-time player, but they have other strikers. They have a midfielder, they have a prime. They can find somebody else. I mean, we've been there. At 98, Aimé Jacquet decided to not take, imagine, Cantona and Ginola. That's a problem of rich people. And that's what it is for Gareth Southgate and Didier Deschamps. And for me, they have... They've been there so many years as a leader of their selection, of their team, national teams, that they should be able to cope with all situations. And for me, they have no excuses.
But I think France have, I wouldn't call it an embarrassment of riches, but he's leaving arguably the best defender in England and William Saliba out. Southgate is not. I mean, how much of a problem is this, James, for Southgate? I mean, it's the lesser of two evils. Where does he go if it's not Maguire and Stones? Where does Southgate turn when there's a problem?
Yeah, it's huge. It's to me, it's the reason why they probably won't win the Euros, because their centre back partnership. I mean, this will be Southgate's fourth tournament. And Maguire and Stones is going to be his centre-back pairing, all things being equal, for all four tournaments. And the previous three, it's not quite been good enough. So why are we thinking it's going to be fourth time around? I think it's, you know, there's a major issue with, I think Mark Gay here at Crystal Palace, I think would have been probably the next choice, the third centre-back, if you like. But he's kind of not really established himself at this level. He really likes Lewis Dunk. Dunk had a bit of a nightmare against Belgium. And again, not really established at this level. Jarrod Branthwaite didn't get a look in this latest camp. And you do sort of look at it and think, well, Luke Shaw, I mean, if Luke Shaw's fit, I think he plays left back. I don't think he's not got the other options at left back to play him as a left-sided centre-back. You know, and try and experiment that way. So, look, I think this comes back to what England's sort of are in the midst, I think, of an existential crisis to some extent. And that is that because of all these attacking players that England have got, the criticism of Southgate is, you know, let the handbrake off, go and play these attacking players. You've got Bellingham, you've got Kane, you've got Foden, you've got Saka, you've got Rashford, you've got all of these top elite players delivering week in, week out for their clubs. Go and let them play, form a team that can go and take the Euros by storm. But the reason why he got a lot of criticism at the previous Euros, because he was playing Rice and Phillips as a kind of holding two in midfield, is because he knew his centre-backs weren't good enough as a back four, as a defensive unit, to just play a single pivot, play 4-3-3 and open up and be that a little bit more expansive and a little bit more creative and take more risks with the ball. And that is where we are now. Southgate's under almighty pressure, and Maynou's emergence has not really helped that, to be honest. Because, he's not really a six either, is he? Let's be honest. I mean, the second half against Belgium, he was playing increasingly further forward, pretty much on the edge of the box for a lot of that game when England had most of the ball. So, you know, people want Southgate to be this more attacking, handbrake off kind of manager. But I think he knows deep down that those centre-backs need more protection. And so I wouldn't surprise me if when we get to the tournament, England are playing maybe 4-2-3-1, letting Bellingham kind of go as a 10 and trying to have two sit in a little bit more, because he knows those centre-backs. And, you know, pace is a big problem. This is the other thing, right? This is why Kyle Walker is such a huge player for England. In that first choice back four, and let's assume that Shaw is fit, and it's Walker, Stones, Maguire and Shaw. There's nobody with pace in that back four apart from Walker. And his recovery pace, you watch England games where he's the one that covers, he covers off from fullback, he gets back in and he spares so many blushes. If England are going to be this team that plays 20 yards further up the pitch, that wants to dominate the ball, dictate play, you know, commit players in advanced areas, they're going to need to find a balance to that team that I'm not sure those centre-backs are good enough to allow them to play the way that a lot of people want England to play. And that you know, France have been there and done it. I don't think they have that issue so much as England do.
I find the comparison between Solgate and Deschamps and
well, that was not, we're not meant a comparison.
Yeah, it's not a comparison. And while... yes, we could question Deschamps and the omission of Saliba this time around. Deschamps has shown that while he's willing to kind of go with his tried and trusted, Olivier Giroud in the World Cup final, if it isn't working out, he'll pull Olivier Giroud and put somebody like Colomwani on. Young players coming through. I've not seen that from Gareth Southgate. And while you can credit Southgate for his successes, relative successes as England manager compared to what we've seen before, he has, as James continues to point out, he continues to stick by who he's always has. And while that may have served you well, you've got to, at some point, this is not your second tournament. This is not your second year in the job. You've been here at this point. Of course there's going to be turnover. Of course there are going to be players aging out and young players coming through. To leave out Menu for Henderson is easily the most bemusing decision I've seen a manager make for quite some time, given the form of both. And listen, I get, again, maybe Henderson gives you a lot off the field, but at some point, you've got to trust that you've built that culture to a point where those senior players can move on, can be left out. And if you don't trust that you've built that culture, then that reflects really poorly on the manager.
But let me go back to that point about Deschamps. The only reason Deschamps took Olivier Giroud off in a World Cup final when he did is because the big cheese Mbappe was chasing absolutely nobody back from a wide position. They were getting horsed down so he put him through the middle. That's the only reason he did it.
He
put Mbappe through the middle and he sacrificed Olivier Giroud because Mbappe wouldn't chase anybody back. And Argentina were tearing him apart down the wider areas. So, you know, to give England their credit, right, I don't know if they'll win this tournament or not. I think if I was a betting man, I'd say probably not. But, you know, they were a Harry Kane penalty away in that France game. They matched France, if not were better than France, for long periods in that game in the World Cup. It didn't happen for them. But they can take that forward, I think. I'm with James. Somehow got to solve what, you know, and I think he's tried a back three before, but I just don't think he'll go to that. But he's got to find a conundrum that allows these others a bit more freedom to go and play, like we've talked about. But that's a difficult balance sometimes when you know you've got a few problems behind you. So you're a bit of a six and two threes. But yeah. You know, I don't know if mine or Garen, I've lost track of where we are, but I've never talked for England for as long.
Or about international football, but we do know that you love the international break, and this segment has been evidenced.
Doesn't everybody love the international break?
Yes, Gab and Robbo do too. They're on the latest Gab and Jill show, looking back on all of it. That's dropped. Make sure to go and check it out wherever you get your podcasts.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPN pods. That's amazon.com/ESPN pods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sports book bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Just taking a look at the Liverpool manager odds, and we're seeing Ruben Amorim up at the top there. There's been some developments in this story, which is why we're now going to welcome in Mark Ogden, who's about to file a report on this very subject. James Ollie's still with us. Tell us more, Mark.
Okay. I filed it, by the way, so I'm done there. Now, basically, Xabi Alonso is not going to go to Liverpool. Liverpool have pulled out there. They've decided that he's... The word they're getting at Leverkusen is that Alonso wants to stay at Leverkusen for at least one more year. So Liverpool are having to look elsewhere. I mean, there's been a few little inklings this week that Alonso wasn't totally keen on being the guy after Jurgen Klopp at Liverpool. But prior to that, I think we've been on the show and talked about it recently that, you know, Michael Edwards has gone back now as the CEO of Fenway Sports Group, who are the football CEO of Liverpool's owners. And he has ideas that are different to what people maybe think about Xabi Alonso. Roberto De Zerbi at Brighton is the guy that is top of his list, but Amorim is another guy that is very highly rated at Liverpool. So I think by the start of next season, the new guy at Liverpool will either be Roberto De Zerbi, who's at Anfield on Sunday, ironically, with Brighton, or Sporting Lisbon's Ruben Amorim. So not Xabi Alonso. He's definitely not going to Liverpool and likely to be staying at Bayer Leverkusen.
Can you see Xabi's point here, Shaka?
I sympathise with it. Listen, as a player, you know you strike when the iron's hot. Big clubs come in for you, you move. As a manager, it's a different dynamic because you can manage for so much longer. And it's Xabi Alonso probably still sees himself in that learning phase. So it comes down to a very personal decision, one that if he stays at Leverkusen, you've got to applaud. Because I think he's seeing a bigger picture to this than many of us are.
It's a risk, isn't it, for him? To an extent, because you never know how football turns.
When it comes around again.
You know, Leverkusen at this moment in time look as if they're going to win the league this year. They've got a handsome lead. Played some great stuff. He's done a great job there. But who knows what next season brings. It could bring, you know, out of the Champions League in Germany in terms of they could be mid-table. You know, you look at what happened at Leicester. It's a different scenario. But you look at what happened at Leicester City. You know, Claudio Ranieri, one of the most experienced coaches on the planet, goes in there, does this magnificent job. Yeah, there's a bunch of guys already there. They win the league. It's an amazing story. I mean, it's just an incredible story. And then next year he's sacked. Things can just turn. So sometimes you try and, you know, plot a way to get somewhere in the end, but it doesn't always work out that way. But I can understand not want. It's a bit like not wanting to follow Fergie, isn't it?
So you're not too surprised then that he's pulled out of this option?
I'm a little surprised because football, it can change very quickly. A good manager can become an average manager pretty quickly, and those jobs, those big jobs, can go away. I mean,
and to that point, as I was saying, if you're a player, you strike while the iron's hot. If Leverkusen lose four or five of their players this summer, which is entirely possible because, again, players' careers are shorter. You move when the opportunity is there. If they lose four or five players, things look very different for Xabi Alonso.
Might it be that there's more options available to him right now?
Oh, possibly. But I think the bigger story is Liverpool, really. I mean, Xabi Alonso will do what Xabi Alonso will do. But this is a huge, huge void to fill at Liverpool. And De Zerbi's been great. This season, it's been a lot more topsy-turvy. If they go there at the weekend and get pummeled by this informed Liverpool team, and they have not defended well this year, Brighton, if they go there and get pummeled, doesn't make them a bad manager, but it makes it a little bit more of a difficult sell.
James, it'll be interesting to get your reaction on this news from Mark and also how it plays into the piece that you've just written about the domino effect of the managerial situation at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we kind of already knew that obviously there were going to be a number of clubs that were looking for managers this summer. And I think part of the problem with Liverpool as a sort of an appeal to any prospective managers replacing Klopp is that they've kind of already rebuilt the squad, right? I mean, they've already spent a lot of the money, rebuilt the midfield. You know, Klopp, prior to the announcement, was talking about this being Liverpool 2.0. You know, this is not Liverpool, I'm building it. And okay, yes, they're ahead of schedule. Obviously, I don't think anybody expected them to be quite so far advanced and in banging the title race as they are. But it's come together very quickly and very well. And if you're looking at that, you're not looking at a team that's thinking, well, you know, are we going to ship one or two out here or three or four out? And can I really stamp my authority on it? Liverpool, it seems to my mind, in terms of the manager they might get in, are they going to the ultimate conundrum is this. Are they going to try and continue the trajectory that Klopp has got them on, or are they going to trust a manager to take them into a different direction? And to me, that is quite closely linked with Mohamed Salah and what they do with him this summer. And Mark and I have debated this before about, you know, do they decide the Saudi money, I think, is going to come again for Mohamed Salah in the summer. He's going to have a year left on his contract. And there's two ways you could play that. If they offer something crazy, if it's, let's just for argument's sake, say it's 200 million, which is the kind of ballpark they were talking about before. Do you take that 200 million for Mohamed Salah and say, OK, to a new manager, yes, the talisman's gone, but this is the money you can reinvest and make this team, make this squad your own? Or do you say, no, Mohamed Salah, we can't lose our iconic manager and our best player in the same summer, but we risk maybe losing him for nothing? And if there's a downturn, if it doesn't go particularly well, and again, there's Saudi money or some other money from somewhere else, they throw it at Mohamed Salah in January, and, you know, he could obviously sign a pre-contract then, or they could lose him for nothing. That it does feel like a real kind of watershed moment. And that, I'm not sure Liverpool have really clarified yet which path they want to take. Do they want to follow the Klopp route, or do they want to rip that blueprint up and entrust it to someone else?
Mark, what would be your opinion on Roberto De Zerbi as Liverpool manager?
Well, you know, you speak to people in the game and he is the guy that everybody's talking about. He is a guy that, you know, you look at his record at Brighton, and like Craig said, they've not really kicked on this year from last year, but obviously they've had injuries, they've lost key players like, you know, Alexis McAllister, Moises Caicedo. I think he's got the characteristics for the job, but anybody following Klopp is going to find it a very difficult job to do. But I think he's a better fit tactically than Xabi Alonso. I think one of the reasons why Liverpool have decided not to pursue Xabi Alonso is the fact that his team is more of a Guardiola-style team. It's more pass sideways and more deliberate build-up rather than the kind of the high-energy game that Klopp plays. And I think De Zerbi is more happy to play. So, you know, De Zerbi's got a lot to prove. He did well at Shakhtar Donetsk, but that's the Ukrainian league. It's not the same level as we're talking about the Premier League. So I think the situation Liverpool have got is that they go for a guy that has got a lot of admirers, but he's not quite proved it as a very big club. And he is quite a spiky character as well. And I think clubs these days, they want coaches who kind of fit in line with what their so-called philosophy is. I think a Ruben Amorim might be more of a happy fit there. And I think you should certainly keep an eye on Amorim. I think he's a strong candidate. I think there's not a lot between De Zerbi and Amorim in terms of the people who are making the decision. But they're not getting Alonso, and I think that will disappoint a lot of the fans. But I think just back to what Shaq and Craig were talking about striking while the iron's hot, there is a train of thought that Xabi Alonso really wants the Real Madrid job, and he's happy to sit it out until Carlo Ancelotti goes. Well, Ancelotti signed a contract earlier this year to 2026. Is he really going to stay at Leverkusen for two more years and risk, like the guys were saying, having a bad season, losing his players? And suddenly, you know, in a year's time, there will be another flavour of the month. And I'm surprised that Alonso is leaning towards staying. I think that could be a mistake, but maybe he's been promised a job somewhere else. We don't know, but I'm surprised. I think if Liverpool had offered him the job, I think he'd find it very hard to turn down. But maybe Liverpool have decided to jump because they're not quite convinced that he's got the right blueprint for the squad that they've got.
Oh, it's interesting, isn't it? And to see if it is going to be Amorim, who has won a league with Sporting himself. Mm-hmm. So obviously that you can see why a name like that is top of the list right now for a position like this.
And he's saying at the moment, well, what does at the moment is he wants to stay at Leverkusen, but there's a big gorilla lurking. It's called Bayern Munich. Do you know what I'm saying? And looking to sort of snaffle up anything they can get, because Thomas Tuchel is going. How successful he'll be before he goes remains to be seen. But I would say if he wants to keep himself hot as the hot topic whilst waiting for another job, I think it would be easier to do it at Bayern Munich than keeping doing it at Leverkusen. So maybe he'll go there, who knows?
It's going to be interesting. Make sure to go and check out that article from Mark Ogden over on the website. Thanks so much for being with us, Mark, to talk about it. And we've also got Transfer Talk, as always, over on ESPNFC.com.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.
Let's see how many problems we have today. Shaka Hislop's international.
By the way, before Shaka starts, just quickly, there are some holes in this.
Hmm? Are there? No, they're
big,
not.
Georgia-shaped holes.
Georgia can't be in there. Georgia win on penalty kicks against Greece. They can't be in there.
To make their first ever major tournament.
Ah, well, congrats, but you can't make the top 10.
Where are you starting?
Where you want to start? African champions in at number 10. Portugal, who I think have every chance in the Euros. But
where did Portugal play? They lost.
Yeah. Nearly everybody lost in here, aside from Argentina and Colombia, who've been simply outstanding. Everybody else had an up and down window, kind of given where we are.
Well, Germany won two games.
But they've won two games in the last 2 years? That's about it. I mean, they've been great. They had a great international window.
Frank's chiming in.
England got a draw and a loss.
Yeah.
At Wembley.
At home. Who else is in that list?
They lost. They lost
Brazil. Brazil didn't lose.
Belgium.
Brazil didn't lose. Shaka.
Yeah.
But again, while they had a good window, Brazil was sixth in CONMEBOL World Cup qualifying. They've had a good window. I'm not taking that away from them, but coming in.
So how far has this gone back?
Oh, this goes way 1978. This goes way back.
Because France, they had a bad window. They got absolutely pummeled by Germany at home.
None of the expected big boys had good windows outside of Colombia and Argentina.
I saw you sort of prancing around in the corridors a couple of hours ago, and I knew you were sort of fretting about this. Sort of, you were stomping around as you do, and I was thinking, big man, Sam.
Steam coming out of his.
He was walking, people were looking
at
him.
It was intense.
People were looking, going, there's a. Call security. There's a man talking to himself in the corridor.
It was intense, couple of hours putting together this list.
Here's the question I always ask you. There's this list that's. Somewhat debatable. Mm. How angry do people get on YouTube?
Very. Yeah, people get really angry.
It's great, isn't it?
Oh, it's
brilliant.
Because if that makes you angry, you know how people think I'm the angry man, right? Which I've got to say, I bat against that. However, I don't get angry at things on YouTube. That's another level. That's up there, isn't it?
Frank was getting angry a minute ago. He wants.
Yeah, Frank wanted in. What did you have to say about the power rankings, Frank?
No, I'm not angry. I'm just. I would say that neither France or England should be in that list after the two games that they had. Even if France won against in Marseille, Chile. I think they didn't have a good game, so I think it shouldn't be there. You know, we consider those two teams like contenders for the next Euro. They're not there right now. They're not there after the two games, for all reasons that you can find. They shouldn't be there. I'm surprised. Yes, with Brazil, when you win at Wembley, and you draw after against I don't know who, but you draw the last minute. I think it's only fair to put them a little bit. Upper in your list, Mr. Hislop. But otherwise, I'm good. I'm happy to see Ivory Coast. Very good. I'm happy to see them. No, otherwise it's fine. I'm good with Shaka.
Right. I'll set up that.
The happiest I've seen Craig in ages on International Week.
I know, right?
Yeah.
What's that?
Love the international power rankings. Got really passionate.
My International Week's finished now.
Love the goals. Oh, is that why you're so happy?
So you're going back and getting angry again?
Yeah.
Or you're happy again?
No, I'm building up for an angry. I'm building up for an angry weekend.
Let's see what version we get of Craig on the latest edition of Extra Time. You can go and check it out over on our YouTube channel. Frank and Shaka are answering your questions too. This weekend, we also see La Liga back. There is a big one between Real Madrid and Athletic Club on Sunday at 2:30 p.m. Eastern. Barcelona will also be taking on Las Palmas. Every single game, all the way through to Mondays, between Villarreal and Atleti, available on ESPN+. Bundesliga is also back, and it brings us Der Klassiker. Bayern Munich taking on Borussia Dortmund. We have an hour's build-up to this game for you. Starts on ESPN+. You can catch it on ESPN as well. Make sure to be with us for Der Klassiker. As for Kicker, over in Germany, the cover says Klassiker with a question mark. Bayern against Borussia Dortmund, this time not a top-of-the-table clash, but still a lot to play for. If you'd like that said how it actually is written, catch Derek Ray tonight on Football Americas with the boys. He will be joined by Sebi and Herc. You can also hear from Ali Riley of Angel City FC. And the extended version brings you Ali Krieger in conversation with Sophia Smith. NWSL this weekend.
I think I'll give it a miss.
featuring Angel City, a Kansas City current, playing them Saturday, 3:30 Eastern, ESPN and ESPN+. Women's Champions League is set. This is how the semi-finals are shaping up. It is Barcelona to take on Chelsea, and PSG have also booked their spot to take on Lyon. And in the Championship, Leeds and Leicester still riding high at the top of the table. 82 points, the two of them. Ipswich just a point behind them as it stands right now. There is a big weekend coming up, and you'll be able to catch some of those games on ESPN Plus Friday. A whole slate of action for you in England's second tier. Bristol City against leaders Leicester City. Norwich City taking on Plymouth. Blackburn against Ipswich. And Watford and Leeds also up there at the top of the table. All of these games available on ESPN Plus. And you can catch Wrexham against Mansfield Town as well. Wrexham can take a huge step towards promotion to the third tier if they beat top of the table Mansfield. You can catch that game, ESPN+. Make sure to be with us from 11 a.m. Eastern. Oh, here we go. This is Neymar at the Miami Marlins taking first pitch.
Yep. Well, okay. And...
not bad.
Yeah, well... What's the point?
Baseball's back. I thought you were a big baseball guy. Yeah.
Yeah, I like. But no, I'm not a big baseball guy. But when if I did watch baseball, I like to watch people throw the ball, not somebody go up there and go.
Oh, the miserable Craig's back just in time for extra time.
When I come in today, did I look like a man that wanted to see Neymar throwing a baseball?
No, but at least it's not Mbappe, hey?
Huh?
You usually don't like us talking about Mbappe, but you bring him up every week. Stick around, extra time's on the way. Welcome into the latest edition of Extra Time. Craig's been warming up all show just to get angry enough for this moment.
He's peaking.
I feel that there's been some, I don't know, preconceived ideas about my temperament.
I wonder where we got that from.
Been fine all week, haven't I?
You have been. Yeah.
I mean, those TVs weren't working.
Yeah, well, got to mention, but, you know.
Of course I got to mention. There was only one game we were supposed to watch. Dan and I and Stevie was the England game against Belgium. And it went wandering off. We couldn't get it. That was the only... we only had one job and we couldn't do it.
Frank's with us as well. Don't worry, maybe you could get it over on Dan's computer. Apparently there's a faster link over there, right?
just my computer doesn't work. Although, I must admit, I've been using his computer. Have you seen it? It needs a good... we're not quite back to the COVID days when you're spraying stuff down, but his needs sprayed down.
His needs a little spray.
His desk area needs a good scrub, I'm telling you now.
Craig,
filthy.
Craig, what do you think about the new rule in the EPL that ball boys are not allowed to throw the ball directly to a player, and now instead players have to get the ball off of cones, seven on each side of the pitch, themselves?
I saw something about this earlier today. And is it something to do with the... I don't know if there's been anything in the EFL, but there was certainly an incident at Bournemouth recently with a ball boy and... who was it? Can somebody enlighten me?
I have no idea.
It'll come to me. An opposing player shoved the ball boy and it And then blah blah blah, it was all sort of sorted out. But I don't know. Are we just taking things too far now? I don't know.
Bit indifferent to this? Or you think it's a little bit too far?
I'm completely indifferent to it.
Right.
I don't see the point of it.
It was Bernd Leno. Bernd Leno, yeah.
It was Bernd Leno in the Fulham game. And then they were all, and the little lad was all right, and I'm sure he got a little girl, can't remember what it was, and I'm sure he got a souvenir, but not suggesting that makes it all right. But, I don't know. What is it? Case they throw it back too quickly, they don't throw it back quickly. Back, I mean, we're now micromanaging everything, aren't we?
Including this. All right, Shaka, did you ever have a run of bad games with several costly mental errors? If so, how did you get yourself sorted out and back to playing well?
Yeah, I think everybody has that spell where you go through and have a ton of errors. Back to basics, just doing things really simply. Don't go. I think the thing that makes things worse and spirals and in a way that you can't get yourself out of is when you start chasing it. You know, from a goalkeeping perspective, when you start coming for every cross because you think, oh, I missed that last cross, so let me go for the next one, or chasing every single through ball. I say do exactly the opposite. Come for the crosses that you know you're going to get and build your confidence from there. And
do as little as possible.
And build from there.
The less you do, the less mistakes you
can make. Set your foundations really low. Set your bar really low and go from there.
Jackie Hislop's philosophy for life.
Well, that's right.
And by the low bar,
yeah.
It's one a lot of people could learn from.
Lower your bar.
All right.
There's a saying in this world, don't be a busy fool.
thank you very much, Craig. Huh. I don't know what that has to do with you being in bad form.
No, I'm just saying, there's a saying, don't be a busy fool. Don't do things you don't have to do to try and impress others. Just let
your
own thing.
Keep your bar low.
Let it
do
be.
Your job. Do your
keep
job.
Your bar low.
For all, during your playing days, Frank, how often did you guys keep in touch with your international teammates throughout the season?
I have to say that I had a wonderful time at Strasbourg the first year where you guys keep in touch with your international teammates throughout. Yeah, and when I started to be with the national team in Strasbourg, I was trying to get in touch with Vicente Lizarazu most of the time. And after when I was in England, at the end of my time at Chelsea for almost a year. I was seeing Emmanuel Petit a lot. He was living close to my area and in close to Chelsea. So we used to see each other a lot and having lunch and talking French in the capital of England. That was great, you know. And I tried to see Patrick Vieira as well. I was organizing dinners at the French embassy, and I remember inviting Steven Wiltord, Robert Pires, Patrick Vieira as well, and that was great. That was a great time that we had together, sharing our experiences living in London.
See the difference? The French are meeting up, sharing dinner at the French embassy.
Speaking French.
We're meeting at the pub playing darts. There's a cultural difference there.
Well, you were meeting up.
They're not eating doner kebabs at 2:30 in the morning and try to hail a cab. Right? They're just not. Or is that just me?
No, not at all.
I used to play golf with Gary McAllister, but I think it might have been just after we finished. But Gary lived in the East Midlands, the same as me, so I'd see Gary now and again. We'd play some golf. But I was good buddies with all the guys, and we had a really solid national team with a very tight-knit squad, but the other side of it was, particularly around 95, 96, I can't remember if we had mobile phones then. I think we may have done, but they were about that size.
Yeah.
You had to hold it with two hands.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Hello. Hello.
And then you pulled a big, there's a big antenna come out the top of it. So I think it was more problematic to be in touch, keep in touch.
I mean, Trandabigo, of course, I stayed in touch with a lot of those guys I grew up with. I played in a junior national team with Dwight when I was 10 years old. So for us to kind of come through the ranks and then, and of course, coming from Trinidad and Tobago, a country as small as ours, the players who end up in England and or Scotland, it's not that many. And, you know, so there's a real kinship there. So we stayed in touch a lot because I just known these guys for so long and still in touch with them to this day.
Does a national team captain have to make sure he's staying in touch with? No, that's not like part of the role.
No.
Okay.
He has to buy the kebabs.
Just been a busy fool, you know.
Yeah.
No.
checking
how they're doing, you know.
Is he drinking?
No, not it's like more, that.
Is he not drinking?
Saying hello, you know.
Yeah.
No.
Who's at the door? Oh, it's the captain. Come to check. I've driven 400 miles just to check that you're in the house.
Sending a letter in the post.
Yeah.
Okay. What's your least favourite kit you ever played in? And this includes youth team kits. Least favourite?
Coventry's. Frank knows this.
Yeah. Yes, away from home.
I never played for Coventry City, but I played in Coventry City's kit in a Premier League game.
Yeah, me too.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, that...
Celtic
away kit. That's the Chelsea away kit in 95. That's the Scotland away kit. Look at the hair. Oh my God.
Oh.
Okay, so these are some that obviously our team didn't like so much.
The Coventry one. You see,
here's the Coventry kit. Tell us more. Tell us the story.
Frank will tell you.
Is that the Coventry kit?
Tell us the story,
there?
Frank.
Our kit man forgot the away kit and we only had the home kit, which of course was blue like Coventry, so we couldn't play with it. And kindly, I have to say, Coventry lent us their shirt, but you can see we hit the badge. And I remember we lost that game and I was so upset at the end. I put everything on the shirt and I threw the shirt on the grass. And the FA, because there were some complaints, rightly, I have to say, complaints about Coventry fans, and I again apologize for that, for my behavior. But the FA sent me a letter saying that I was the last time that we threw a shirt on the grass. Otherwise, I'm gonna be suspended. So, and after the other one is the away shirt. That was a great one. I think the Chelsea fan loved that one. And the last one is Al Sadd, the Qatari shirt from the club that I became champion the first year that I played in Qatar. With the number one, you can see on the short, my number is number one. I had number one shirt.
What are you doing in your mouth here? What's this?
I don't know. I was saying to the referee that he had a smelly breath that he should put some mint stuff. I don't know what I'm doing.
So it was interesting, the game at Highfield Road, as it was then, Coventry. We're talking about, you got one job, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The kit man's got one job, right? Is to put the away kit in the hampers, in the big kit hampers, and take them to Coventry. And it was quite funny, because Rudd was the manager, Rudd Hewlett, and he couldn't get his head around it. How is this possible? He was walking around saying, how is this possible? How is this possible? Hey guys, how is this possible? He must have said that. How is this possible? And when he lifted, but before that, when the kit man went, right, he lifted the hamper up, he went... Boss, there's a problem.
We have a problem.
when is that West Ham one year? I can't remember if this was my first or second year. But we got not a real game, a pre-season friendly. We get there, no boots. No boots are on the bus.
Game's off.
So I think the kit man had kind of dawned on him halfway there or something like that. And then he had to jump out, get a car to take him back. So we had to warm up in trainers. Because we were in track suits and the trainers. We just had to kind of warm up in trainers as best we could, wait for the boots to arrive, and then put them on the plate. No boots.
Oh, yeah, that would be a problem. you're not getting away with this.
What?
Yeah, you're not going to.
Oh. Oh, legendary kits.
The shorts.
Oh, yeah, the short shorts. Yeah, let me tell you something. Those two on the left were Reading kits. Those.
Yeah, why did you go from the... You've sort of sandwiched the sort of tight-fitted...
So, the one in the middle... Well, the middle and the one to the left, those are Reading. That was...
But they're so big. They're baggy.
Yeah, that was my style.
Well, you're not your style. Look at your style.
Well, that's when I first arrived. They gave me those. That's all they had. The middle one. That's all they had.
Well, then what's wrong with the middle one?
Too short. Too small.
No.
Then I went from there to the big ones. And then I continued at Newcastle. Newcastle had some great kits, by the way.
Oh. We can see that.
No, it's interesting you say that, because we wanted to ask you how much you think a signed Shaka jersey from those days would cost.
Oh, I don't know. Not much.
$5.
Yeah, not much. The Newcastle shirt.
You underestimate yourself.
That includes package and postage.
You underestimate yourself. Do you care to have a guess, Frank?
Why, who's selling it? Somebody got a hooky one on eBay.
So it's more than one that's for sale.
Really?
It's a similar price.
Shh, it's him that's selling it.
I'm going to buy it.
So a signed Shaka jersey.
Oh, how much I would be ready to pay?
How much you would pay? Pounds.
I think something like, I would say like $300, easily. Yeah. What? It's Shaka Issa, come on.
I'll give you a call after the show, Frank.
Still very below what's actually out there right now.
What?
Mm-hmm. Are we going to get to this or what?
We could double that.
Yeah?
What?
Yeah. Who's buying it?
Oh, you see?
I don't know who's buying it. But they are.
There's
two that are up for sale for over £600.
Hold on.
That's the value.
Shouldn't that come your way?
It's crazy how much.
Don't worry.
It's crazy
it
how
be.
Much the family is ready to pay. And Shaka, it's crazy how much the family, your family, is ready to pay.
To make me feel good. I'm a family willing to pay to make me feel good.
Yep, there you go. I'll show you the proof later. If
yeah, I am. I am shocked at that.
Well, maybe we've just put the price up as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
That is further confirmation that this world, there's a lot of idiots out there.
I get
if you didn't need to, didn't know that already.
I get one for birthday. I get one for your birthday, Craig.
Yeah.
All right.
All yours.
To all, who's the one manager currently managing in the Premier League you'd have enjoyed playing under, aside from Pep or Klopp, currently managing?
Currently?
Okay. Let me think. We'll go down. See, Arteta is too intense for me, that.
Yeah, it's kind of intense.
You don't think you'd like those mantras?
If he's bobbing around the touchline, he's a target.
I know, I have my answer.
I'm not taking the light bulb stories and all that.
I have my answer.
He's done great, but so he's not me.
You ever think, your answer is...
I need the league table.
Postecoglou. Yes.
I think he's a great manager. I like him a lot.
Right.
Really, really.
What about you, Frank?
Yeah, I'm with Shaka. I mean, I feel the vibe that guy is put inside the dressing room and how much he changed the dressing room and the brain of the player has completely changed into a positive way. I would have been thrilled to play under him. And otherwise, yeah. You know what? What his name? It's just at the edge of my tongue, as we say.
What team?
He was at Leicester, then came to Scotland.
Brendan Rodgers.
At that time, when he was at Leicester, I would have loved to be with him because I feel that the guy is a good guy. And he has some good theory, and I like the way he was handling his dressing room as well.
Yeah, Postecoglou, I have to join the board. I couldn't think of anybody. I needed a league table in front of me,
right?
So I could look down, you know, just helps.
Oh, what about Eddie O? What about Eddie O, Shaka?
Yeah,
Eddie Howe. Eddie O.
Eddie O.
What about Eddie O?
He's kind of intense to you.
Eddie O.
So I went I was up there a couple of years ago, I went to Newcastle's training, and he's far more intense than I expected.
you went, you busy fool. Why are you going to training?
Well, I was up there.
Are you selling shirts?
She's the mayor of Newcastle.
When I was up there 2 years ago.
Yeah, what are you going to train for? You're done. You can't.
To see my former teammate.
Guest appearance.
Who's your former teammate?
Ariel.
He's the mayor of Newcastle.
Where was he, your teammate?
Don't forget.
Pompey.
Was he?
Yeah.
All right, fair enough. So you're mingling with managers now?
Yeah, that's how I roll in my off time.
Wrexham manager, Phil Parkinson.
That's used to former play with teammate him, at Reading, yep. Correct?
So you can go to Wrexham.
Gary O'Neill.
Yep.
Play with him at Pompey.
We've all got teammates that are managers.
I'm just saying.
We don't come on here and blow our horn about it.
Well, I'm just saying, I was going to see, you asked me what I was doing there. I just said I wanted to see my former teammate.
Right, you're not in that. You're on the other side of the fence now. You shouldn't be fraternising. You shouldn't be fraternising with managers and players.
Next question. Start, bench or sell peak versions of Van Dijk, John Terry and Vidic?
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Right, well, we're going to leave this to the centre-half.
Yep.
Yeah, leave it.
Leave this to Frank. There you go.
Wow. Wow, 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 wow. I have to go for...
I know
John Terry,
top.
My kid. Yep. And after Vidic and after Van Dijk. I'm sorry, but it's so hard and it's a shame to put one of them last. But Vidic was simply amazing. I mean, John Terry, I saw him growing up, being the I was substitute for Marcel and I. I never expected to see him going that high. And his power, his consistency at the top level is simply amazing. And because I saw him training, working hard, being only with short sleeve in winter, I have to put him first. I don't know Van Dijk a lot. So I saw him when he was at his peak. He was amazing, of course. But I saw Vidic playing. Vidic was, he was a pit bull. He never let go. And when he beat you, it was over for you. Amazing defender. But John Vidic, Van Dijk.
It's harsh. Only one of those won Player of the Year, by the way. Van Dijk. Just saying.
It sounds like you're starting Van Dijk.
Yeah, I'm putting him first. I don't know who I'd put second.
I think Terry was. I could go either way with the second two, but Terry, John Terry, was a young boy at Chelsea when I was there. Went out and loan to Nottingham Forest, got some experience. Then I left and blah blah blah. And I don't know how much longer, a couple of years. People don't realise he was a colossus for a long time for that club. I mean, he really was, you know.
Hey, let's be honest, three good defenders there.
Yeah, that's one of the most I've seen you guys stumped on when you first say
yeah,
it
Yeah, I
out.
Mean, there's no real wrong answer
yeah,
there.
Yeah,
that's
three
just,
incredible
that's
defenders
just,
there.
It's just an opinion.
All right, what would go through your mind during lull periods of a game? Got to start with the goalkeeper on that one.
Well, in all seriousness, you're just trying to stay focused because you know it's coming. I used to spend a lot of time running around in my box, so I'm sure I've told this story before. Back in our day, you used to have the Opta Index, and you used to measure how much you run. So, it was pretty crude compared to today's standards. So come session on Monday, training on Monday, and Harry would break out all the stats. I would have run further than half the team. It was
staying
great, because when the boys up there, then, I just used to be running up and down and running all around. I used to come out every Monday looking like, yeah, oh, look how much grouch I can come out. I'm like, that's right.
That's right.
So that's what I did in my lull periods, run around.
You don't really get many lull periods when you're playing central midfield, to be honest. So,
yeah.
I don't know if you used to do this. Particularly towards the end of my career, I used to look at the clock a lot. You know, in every ground there'd be a huge, big clock. And if the game was going, if the game wasn't going very well, I used to glance at it all the time. I used to go tick, tuck. It would be like slow. I'd be like, oh my God, 10 minutes to go.
That's so funny to think of footballers doing that, because it's usually what people do in an office job. Or are we going home yet?
No, well, think about it. If you're winning a game and the game's tight, right? If you're beating somebody 2-1, it's a big game. you're under a bit of pressure. You're looking at the clock. Yeah.
Right,
you're looking at the clock
and going, over.
Ref, how long's left? And maybe the ref not talking to you, or he's away somewhere. You're looking at the clock. And then the other sense, if it's not, you know, sometimes he's just...
He's just bored.
I used to say to the ref sometimes before... I used to go in the tunnel before a game and I'd say, any chance you can just make this like 20 minutes each way today?
What you still say when you come in the studio?
Yeah,
the
I don't say, listen, it's been a long day, but just make it 20 minutes each way and we can go home.
Nobody will mind.
Nobody.
Frank, did you always stay laser focused throughout the whole game?
Of course not, you know. The first year at Chelsea, I was watching Craig Burley on my little period, you know. I was saying, what is he doing?
He was watching. He couldn't take a break because he was waiting on one of my mistakes. I had to defend.
Exactly. I remember that the only time that I never thought about something else on the field, and that was like Craig, watching the clock, watching the fans, you know, watching my teammates playing and I say, what the hell are they doing? But the only game that I was 100% focused on my duty was the World Cup final, when I had to make sure I knew where Ronaldo was putting himself, you know, because I knew that the time they got the ball back, if I didn't know where he was, it would have been a threat and a real danger for us. So I was watching him all the time and say, okay, we have the ball, but he's there. So when we lose the ball, I have to go there. That was crazy. I was exhausted at the end of the game. But otherwise, yeah, I was doing like I actually said one time to the ref at 3-0 halftime, he said, can we not come back? Second half, they're not going to come back. So what the point? You know, we're going to thrash them. It's going to be humiliating for them. So can we go back home straight away? He laughed.
People don't realise sometimes the conversations that go on the field.
Yeah. With one another.
Maybe it's changed. I don't think so.
And refs. Certainly back in the day, you could have conversations with refs.
Yeah.
You could have a lot of fun with refs back
in the day. Maybe it's changed. Maybe they don't have these. I remember when I was at Celtic, it was the first year we were going for the... Rangers had won all these titles and we were trying to stop them winning 10 titles in a row. It was a huge season. And I think we were playing, and we used that year with a great bunch of lads at Celtic, a good mix of some of the Scandinavian boys, new signings, the French, Italian, British. But we used to go to Dublin, I'm going to say twice a year, as a group, 12 of us or whatever, and we'd finish the game on a Saturday, and if we were playing Hibs in Edinburgh, we'd go to Edinburgh Airport, go to Dublin, and we'd have a couple of days drinking Guinness and blah, blah, blah. And so we're playing at Easter Road, I think it was Easter Road, and we're playing Hibs on a Saturday, and it's a tight game. I mean, tight as hell. We're going to Dublin that night. Alan Stubbs, our centre-half, goes for a ball, and their striker, I don't know if he headed him or clattered him, anyway, he's got a big cut. Stubbs is going to Dublin, right? He's got this big cut on his forehead, or it looked like it. He's on the ground, there's blood everywhere. Brian Scott runs on, the physio, right? And there's about six of us, seven of us went round Stubbsy. He's lying on the ground and Scotty's wiping all the blood away. And we're going for the title. And Scotty, he said, what? He said, is he going to be okay for Dublin? Scotty, the Brian, the physio. Now, bear in mind, we're in a league, we're in a fight for the title. Brian looked up and went, yeah, no problem, okay, that's good. We couldn't care. We couldn't care if Stubbsy had to go off and be replaced. But the most important thing was the big man.
Make the flight.
The big man had to make the flight. It was paid for, we were going to Dublin, and he was on the ground, Stubbsy, he went, I'll be all right, man. And he's got blood all running down his face. So, I mean, you have these sort of moments that people think are... More serious.
More tense than
that. Yeah, there's always a bit of... You have to, because of the pressure. You have to have a little bit of...
Comic relief.
Yeah, quite.
All right, Shekhar, besides your algorithms, do you use your knowledge of differential equations in your top 10 selections?
Not differential equations, no. There's a lot of math that goes into it, as you know, Kay, and you're a witness today.
Dead?
Yep.
But not differential equations. That's just wrong department.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Well, thanks so much for sending in your questions. Thanks to the guys for the stories, and we'll do it all over again tomorrow. See you later.
Some of you will.
Wednesday night on ABC. Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking at that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia. Wednesday night at 10, 9 central on ABC.